filthy room that looked like it had once been a hospital. I was on a gurney, and I was unable to move, despite the fact that I could see no visible restraints. I craned my head around, trying to get a sense of my surroundings. There was a huge cockroach crawling up my shirt toward my face. That's what it most resembled, anyway. It was fully 2 inches long and had tiny pincers, like a crab. I tried to kind of shake my chest to knock it off, but I couldn't even move enough to do that. I heard a voice say, "You're awake," and I saw Nymph step out of the shadows. It was that fit and well-to-do version of myself, only instead of a suit, he was wearing the same clothes I had on, stained jeans and an old t-shirt that said Chicago Bears 1984 Super Bowl Champs, around a navy and orange-clad Dan Marino, as if to mock me. I said, "Is that actually you, or is this just more hallucination bullshit?" He didn't answer, just smiled. I said, "Because if it's you, I have a bunch of questions, but I'm not going to bother if it's just some symbolic bullshit meant to teach me something about myself."
"Tell me," said Nymph.
"If I asked you to eat that insect on your shirt, would you?" I didn't answer. What was the point? He continued, "What if I left and came back a week from now? Would your hunger be such that you would be willing to eat it then?" The bug was scaling a wrinkle in my shirt just above my nipples. It had yellow eyes. It blinked. "The answer is 46, Nymph said before I could answer. "That's how many hours without food you could go before willingly eating a living insect. At any given moment, you are less than 2 days from abandoning all dignity in the name of desire." Next, he gestured to the corner and said, "What about that corpse of a small child lying over there?" There was, in fact, a little boy there, lying still in a fetal position, dark skin, maybe Hispanic. "How long until you would eat him?" "I know the answer, but I'm curious to see how far off your own estimate is. I also know what that number would be if the boy was alive." I said, "The thing in the old coal mine, your master. What is it? What does it want?" He cocked his head with a look that said, "Are you seriously asking me that?" I tried again, because why not? Why is it trying to brainwash people with the idea of fake offspring? What's the point? Is it all just a game? Did the master get bored? Nymph took a few strides my way and stopped next to a rusty metal tray attached to the gurney. "Look." On the tray were three objects: a surgeon's scalpel, a hunk of black rock that had been chiseled into a crude blade, like something you'd find at an archaeological dig, a hunk of black rock that was still in standard rock shape. "Obsidian," said Nymph. "All three, I mean. Did you know that the sharpest blades in the world are made from obsidian? This scalpel has been sharpened to an edge just 30 angstroms wide, 1/100,000,000th of a centimeter. A razor's edge is 20 times thicker by comparison. So, let me ask you, which of these three tools would you like me to use to remove your face?" Since we both had my face, I actually wasn't sure if he was talking about removing it from my skull or his. Not that it mattered, since this was all some sort of vision and wasn't actually happening. "Are you absolutely sure of that?" The bug had reached the top of my shirt, standing on the elastic neckband. There was a soft hissing noise, and I realized I could hear the thing breathing, labored, like its tiny lungs had asthma. "How about this?" Nymph said. "I will ask you a question. If you answer correctly, we move on to the next round. If you answer incorrectly, I make a single circular incision beginning behind your right ear, looping around under your chin, behind your left ear and across your forehead, meeting back at the right ear again. Then I simply peel off your face, like peeling an orange."
Here is the question. Which of those three is a naturally occurring object? I had trouble understanding how I was going to get any useful information this way, but it didn't seem like I had any choice but to play along. I looked over the three objects. Which is naturally occurring? He asks. Well, the scalpel was obviously man-made. Of the other two hunks of obsidian, one looked untouched by human hands, owing its shape to wind or erosion or whatever. The other had clearly been chipped into a blade, maybe by an ancient caveman. So it was made of stone, which is naturally occurring. But the blade shape was man-made. Seemed like a semantic argument to me. The man with my face said, "You have 30 seconds to answer, and then I start cutting." There is no right answer. You could make the argument that both the... And then it hit me. "Okay," I said, "I get it. All three are naturally occurring." "Please, explain." "Because humans shape the stone blade and manufacture the scalpel, but humans are naturally occurring organisms, so anything we build or create is also naturally occurring." "Correct. Erosion by flowing water and chiseling by human hands are both just atoms moving atoms. Molecules grow into cells, and cells grow into brains and organs and limbs to shape the stone. A colony of fungi, an anthill, a human city, all are a convergence of particles and forces that alter the landscape. In fact, any substance or occurrence that is not naturally occurring must, therefore, be supernatural in nature. So, that leads us to the second question. Of the two cutting tools you see before you, which was made by choice? I see where this is going. Do you? The crude blade there was made 500,000 years ago by a hooting, stinking creature you would in no way recognize as human. So when that hairy primate fashioned this blade for the purpose of slicing meat from bone, the same purpose I intend to use it for, did it choose to do it? Or was it just following its animal instincts, the way an insect will scurry from the light? The wheezing bug on my chest had crawled off my shirt, and I could feel its feet tickling my neck. He said, 20 seconds. "I don't know, man. Ask a scientist. Maybe it was just hungry and had a dead animal in front of him he couldn't bite into." "So, you're saying that hunger was the inventor. Why, then, is that different from the scalpel? Otherwise, you would be suggesting that there is an energy that allows you, as a man, to defy the simple mechanism that causes the tree to grow toward sunlight or the insect to flee from it. An energy that lets you defy the physical chain reactions that govern the behavior of literally everything else in the universe, from subatomic particles to the grunting ancestor who made this blade. An energy that exists only in modern humans. Then none of them were made by choice. That's the answer you want, isn't it? So there you go, that's my answer. We're all just fucking animals or whatever. How is that relevant to the situation at hand? Final question. If you are correct, and we are not able to make choices, and are just following the same impulses as the insect, then how do I have the choice to not peel your face? I would be driven along by impulse, as beholden to them as that insect. The bug was scaling my chin now. It was breathing hard with the effort. I thought I heard it curse under its breath. I said, "What you're saying is that you're going to peel off my face one way or the other, which is irrelevant because this isn't actually happening. Right?" "You tell me." Nymph snatched the scalpel and climbed up on the gurney, straddling my chest. He grabbed my face, but then things got confused, and suddenly I was the one on top, the struggling man's face in my own grip, the scalpel in my hand. It was John on the gurney, not me. The blade pierced skin, and I pulled it across his jawline. Chapter 16. The Great Dildo Flood. I snapped back into my own body and found I was, in fact, straddling John. In my hand, instead of a scalpel, was a pink dildo. I was pressing it against his chin as if trying to slice it open. John, meanwhile, was cramming something into my face, something that was crumbling against my jaw. We were splashing around in an inch of dirty water. John said, "Eat it! Eat it, you son of a bitch!" I said, "Wait! Stop!" We both blinked and froze in place, taking in our surroundings. We were in the Venus flytrap, which had now succumbed to the encroaching flood. There were open, empty sex toy packages scattered around the floor, as if the place had been ransacked by looters looking to spice up their marriages. The place smelled like farts. I got up off of John. He groaned and dumped something out of his hand, a handful of Oreo cookies he'd been trying to shove into my mouth for some reason. He stood up out of the water, then lit a cigarette. I said, "What happened? How long was I out?"
"I don't know. What's the last thing you remember?"
"Soy sauce, at the Beanie Weenie Cannery. I got some in my system. Everything went weird. Then I woke up here, just now." John nodded.
"Yeah, me too."
"You took off running. You dove through a second floor window."
"No memory of that. I'm really sore, though. Got scratches all over me."
I called out for Amy. No answer. A hint of sun was peeking through the windows from the east. There were several shopping sacks from a local hardware store near the door. I briefly looked through them and found several sealed plastic bags of a bright yellow powder. One had burst, spilling its contents. Sulfur. So that's where the stink was coming from. Had we bought it? If so, why? I checked to see if I had my phone, and did. I dialed Amy. She answered,
"Is this you? Where are you?"
"Venus flytrap. I woke up and John and I were having a dildo battle."
"Where have you been?"
"Don't know. How long have I been gone? All night?"
"All night? This is Monday morning. You've been gone for 2 days.
"Oh, shit. Have you not heard from me at all? You took the soy sauce, you looked at Chastity and yelled, 'It's dildos all the way down, baby,' and ran out of the building. You had told her to wait an hour, but you never came back. That was Friday night. She actually stayed until the next morning, but she's long gone now. I hear nothing all day Saturday or Sunday. I've been worried sick. What were you doing for 2 days?
"No idea. Maybe it'll come back to me."
"And nobody has come after you?"
She said, "Not so far. Maybe they don't work weekends."
"Okay. Okay, so where are you staying?"
"I've been sleeping at the Beanie Weenie. Didn't know where else to go. Been sleeping in my clothes on the sofa, freezing at night. Got Nikki to bring me food. Nobody has bothered me here, though."
"Okay, good. Well, shit, I'm sorry, Amy, but maybe John and I took care of it. While we were on the sauce, maybe we fixed everything. Have there been, any more developments while we were gone?"
"Yes, 10 more kids have gone missing."
"Did you say 10?
"Went missing yesterday, all from the same place, the Roach Motel. They were the biker kids. They had a room there they were using as a daycare. Yesterday, most of the bikers were out at a memorial for Lemmy. They came back. The lady who was watching the kids was frantic. Says she turned her back for 1 second, and they were gone. Christ's rebellion is on the warpath. They're tearing the town apart."
"Shit. Wait, now hold on. Are these real kids, or is this a situation like Mikey?"
"I've seen photos."
"Oh, you have?"
"Yeah. I'm talking to the parents now. I'm at the motel."
"What are you doing out there?"
"I just told you. We're trying to help them find out what's going on. What did you think I was doing all weekend? I'm working the case."
"All right. All right. We'll be right there."
"The world doesn't just grind to a halt when you're not around, David."
"I know. I'm sorry. Jesus. I love you." "I love you too." I hung up, and we sloshed out into the parking lot. John's Jeep was parked there, so we'd apparently gone back to get it at some point. A sign on the Venus flytrap door announced they had closed until further notice due to flood conditions. The entire neighborhood wasn't underwater, not yet, but at this point it was a few islands of dry land where certain lots and patches of road were elevated. Everything else was swamped by a couple of inches of swirling brown water, the currents carrying sticks and garbage and clumps of dead grass. We went upstairs to find the apartment pretty much as I'd left it, aside from the fact that there were now boxes piled everywhere. There were 10 cases of Mountain Dew Code Red stacked by the door. There was a shipping invoice on the card table. Apparently, I had spent part of the Mikey Payton reward money having a bunch of soda overnighted to the apartment. Nearby were 8 much larger boxes labeled Velvet Soft Erotic Silicone Buttocks. One of us, hopefully John, using his credit card, had apparently bought every single rubber-ass sex toy from the shop downstairs. I looked at John and started to ask if this was his doing, but he just shook his head, slowly. No memory either way. I dug out a bottle of Mountain Dew and told him about the missing kids. Wait, just hold on. If they're decoys, could they just brainwash a whole group like that, a whole community? That, I said, is what we have to figure out first. I went into the bathroom to take a piss and saw that scrawled on the mirror were 3 words, written backward in what was hopefully black dry erase marker. Atterol ot clot. It was Talk to Loretta written in a mirror image, which made no sense because the text was written on the mirror itself, so it still read backward to me. If they'd written it on the wall behind the mirror, that would have worked. I recognized the handwriting as John's. I said, I think we're supposed to go talk to Ted's wife. I rubbed the ink on the mirror. It was not dry erase. John looked it over and said, why didn't we just go talk to Loretta instead of leaving ourselves a note to do it later? Maybe we... No. John.
What?
You didn't leave a bunch of cryptic clues behind because you wanted to do a dude where's my car situation. You did not do that. Please, tell me.
Well, if I did, I'm sure I had a good reason. You know what? I bet the butts are a clue too.
Oh my God. Look, what matters is that we go talk to Loretta. Like the note says, maybe she'll have the next clue. Fuck you. We're going to the Roach Motel. That's where Amy is. I thought for a moment and said, it just occurred to me that she said we when she said she was at the motel. I wonder who's with her.
Maybe it's the cops. Or it's that dude from work she's having an affair with.
On the way to the motel, we came across several side streets that had been closed by the city for being underwater. Not enough to drown in, but definitely enough to ruin your traction if you weren't paying attention. I could only remember one really bad flood in my time living here when I was 10. They had canceled school for 3 weeks, and then everything smelled like fish for a month after the water went down. This looked worse. The entrance to the Roach Motel parking lot was blocked by a pair of scary-looking biker dudes. We pulled up, and the bigger of the two said,
"We're closed."
Up from behind the men walked not Amy or Chastity, but that goddamned non-agent Helen Tasker. She muttered something to the big biker, and he stepped aside, giving us the stink eye as we passed. I said to John, "You didn't happen to bring a gun, did you?
Just let me do the talking."
We parked, and as soon as John jumped out, he said to Tasker, "So, you're not dead, then?" "Why would I be?"
"You got shot right in the chest like 2 days ago."
"How high were you when you came to see me Friday night?"
"I came to see you?"
"So, pretty high, then." I'm not repeating the conversation. My employers administered first aid, and I was back on duty within an hour. There's not even a scar.
"Impressive. Is your partner around?"
His brain was hit with a neuron scrambler and his entire upper body was crushed by an SUV. He won't be back on duty until later this afternoon. John nodded.
"Sure. So, can you give me a brief summary of what we talked about Friday night?"
"You asked for my help."
"I did?"
"Yes, with a bunch of children who were about to go missing." Amy approached from behind Tasker, wearing her red raincoat that made her look like the little girl from Schindler's List. She walked right up to Tasker and said, "I got him to talk to me. He says half of the CR thinks the kids were taken by a rival gang called the Flatlanders. Some think they were raptured by God and that this is the end of the world. The rest think it was the Bat Mantis. Some say they even saw it that day." Amy glanced at me and John and said, "You guys look awful." Tasker said, "What was that third thing?" I said, "It's not relevant to the case. A YouTube video of a winged monster went viral around town. Now people think they're seeing it everywhere. Typical Bigfoot shit. So, you two are partners now?" Exasperated, Amy looked at John and said, "You told her to come find me." I said, "All right, calm down." To Tasker, I said, "The bikers are talking to you despite the fact that you staged a weird battle in their parking lot like 2 days ago?" Amy said, "They think she's with the FBI. She has credentials from every agency." I said, "Great. Have you broached the subject with the agent here that there might not be any missing kids at all? That it's all just a series of false memories planted by a hive of mind-controlling, shape-shifting bug monsters?" The look on Agent Tasker's face confirmed that Amy had not, in fact, broached that subject. John said, "Wait, were you withholding that from her for a reason? In that case, forget we said anything." Amy hand-waved it away. "They've got documents, pictures. They're real kids." John scrunched up his eyebrows in thought. "Can we see the pictures?" We followed Tasker into the front office, which had apparently been commandeered by the FBI. It stank of cigarettes and engine grime. Tasker had the documents in a folder she pulled from a flat black briefcase that automatically unlocked when she spoke to it in Latin. She pulled out a handful of pages and handed them to John. He flipped through them and said to Tasker, "And these all check out? They're not forgeries or anything?"
"No. Why would they be?"
He said to Amy, "You've looked at them too? They look genuine?"
"They don't look like Photoshops or anything.
I'm not an expert. Why?" John handed me the pages. Every single one of them was blank. I sighed.
"You explain it. My head hurts."
John took a breath, not sure where to start. Finally, he turned to Amy and said, "While I was on my soy sauce trip, I saw something. A memory, replayed from the third person. It was me, showing up at the Knoll house meeting with Detective Bowman. And we're talking, and Bowman asks for a recent photo, and Ted opens his wallet and hands the detective an old membership card from Blockbuster Video. The detective looks at it and starts talking like he's looking at a photo, asking if the girl's hair is still that long and so on. Then he hands it to me. And I showed it to Dave when he arrived. Always that plastic blue and yellow Blockbuster card. Each time we see a little girl's face, which makes sense because if the fuck roaches can rewrite memories from a certain distance away, then they can make you remember seeing what they want you to a split second after you look. So the cops or somebody could devote a whole weekend to searching through government databases for these kids, and they'd have a vivid memory of successfully finding page after page of records. But if Dave and I were watching them work, and I mean right now, while we're still under the effects of the sauce, we'd see them staring at a blank computer screen or doing nothing at all." Amy said,
No, it can't work like that."
"Why not?"
"Because then how could you trust anything you saw or heard?"
I thought, "Exactly."
Agent Tasker said, "You're going to need to back up. What exactly are you suggesting?"
So we told her. When we finished, she got an expression on her face like a short order cook who just saw a huge group of hungry drunks walk in 5 minutes before closing time. She said, "I have to take this to my superiors." I said,
"Sure, let us know what they say."
"You wouldn't be capable of understanding what they say. Go home and wait there. Don't talk to anyone."
The news media will find out about the missing children eventually, but the longer we put that off, the better chance we have at containment.
Are you listening? I said, huh?
Yes, thank you. I've been doing a lot of squats.
She turned and banged through the door, showing no reaction to the driving rain.
As soon as she was gone, I said to Amy, we found a clue pointing toward Loretta, Ted Knoll's wife. We need to go talk to her.
A clue?
John said, I had written talk to Loretta on your bathroom mirror.
Any idea why that you can think of?
It sounds like a dude where's my car situation to me.
No, I mean why we'd need to talk to Loretta specifically.
Amy said, well, I think Loretta has Maggie, or...
Amy made one set of air quotes with her fingers. She has Maggie.
John said, oh, right.
I said, so we just have to go and, explain the situation. She'll understand, right?
John said,
you think 20 silicone sex butts would convince her?
Chapter 17. Joining Maggie for breakfast. The three of us headed to Loretta's house, but had decided that we wouldn't stop if Ted's car was parked there, since we assumed he still was determined to shoot me on sight. No Impala. Still, we took the minor precaution of parking at Taco Bill instead of in front of Loretta's house. The restaurant had a spray-painted sign in the window that said, "Still open, fuck the flood." Though it looked like they had maybe 48 hours before the cooks would be standing in puddles while they grilled the flank steak. Cars were creeping down the street, swerving out across the painted lines to avoid the overflowing gutters. To John, I said, so this meeting you had with the non-agent Friday night, you've no recollection of it?
Well, you know how it is on the sauce. You see things. Seems like a dream. Or the memories from when you're a little kid, the ones where you're not sure if they happened, or if your brain just cobbled the memory together after you've heard the story secondhand. So, I have this memory of running out of the Beanie Weenie building, and I think, I need transportation. Then this guy on a crotch rocket Suzuki motorcycle, just like the one I owned years ago, rides up and asks if I'm John. Says he got a letter 5 years ago telling him to deliver a motorcycle to that specific place and time. So I jump on and I ride and I run into the non-convoy. I somehow know which truck has Agent Pusnado in the back.
Amy said, excuse me, who?
The agent we just talked to? Anyway, I jump off the motorcycle onto the hood of the truck. No, this is how I remember it. And they screech to a stop, and I yell at the driver that I need to talk to her, that it's for everyone's safety. She lets me in the back of the truck, and it's just me and her. I tell her I need 5 minutes. She says she needs 8 inches.
Amy said, oh my God.
I said, that is not what happened. That's how I remember it, I swear.
Do you remember anything else from when you were out? Anything that's not completely fucking stupid? Anything about Loretta or Maggie? Anything that would help prepare us for what we're about to walk into here?
He shook his head. I don't know. I don't think so.
You?
No. I had a vision I ran into Nymph and he tried to tell me the meaning of life, then I woke up.
Amy said, anyway, obviously I have to go in again because I assume Maggie and Loretta both still think you're the kidnapper.
You're not going in there alone, not after what happened last time. If we have to just barge in there and do it by force, we will.
Amy said, do what by force?
Take out Maggie?
The sign said talk to Loretta, not murder Loretta's child.
It's not a child.
We don't know that yet. Look, you guys feel free to keep debating it. I'm going in. I'll stick my phone in my coat pocket and you can watch.
I said, but what if Maggie turns into...
Shh, let me finish. The danger isn't Maggie turning into a big snake monster or something. The danger is she messes with my brain somehow. If she turns into a big monster, I'll scream and run away. If she starts messing with my head, you guys will need to get me out of there and slap sense into me.
I said, I don't like it either way.
Sure, and you can sit out here and contemplate how much you don't like it while I go inside.
She opened the door. Love you.
I love you too.
We watched from afar as Amy's red coat bounced through the rain. She knocked on Loretta's door, then apparently got an okay to come in. I started watching on my phone, but didn't have a great view. The camera was just barely peeking up over the pocket of her coat. Amy pushed in through the door and appeared to be responding to a friendly greeting that I couldn't quite hear over the rustling of her coat against the microphone. I said, I don't like this. John said, yeah, I think you said something about that. We'll give her 1 minute. Then we bust in. Amy entered the living room. We could faintly hear Loretta talking from the kitchen, saying, actually, she's handling it better than the grown-ups. But, you know, kids are tough. John was here yesterday. He explained everything. I know you're trying to help, despite what Ted thinks. And now all those other kids are missing. Awful. Amy said, oh, I didn't know John had come by. What, did he explain exactly? On Amy's camera, we watched Loretta step into view holding a mug of coffee. Half of her was missing. She looked like she'd been torn apart by a great white. Most of her neck was gone, to the point that it should have been impossible for her to hold her head upright. Just a white spinal column and a yellowish ligament surrounded by ragged meat and open air. About a third of her torso had been ripped away from armpit to hip. She continued talking like everything was fine. I could see her windpipe twitching, her exposed lung inflating and deflating with each breath. That woman should not be alive. John gave a start, and I knew he could see it too. But Amy replied politely to the conversation, oblivious. Loretta said, John told me the police had turned you loose, that the bad guy had the same build and hair color as your David, but that they'd eliminated him as a suspect. Still, I'd prefer he not come in. Maggie is still in bed, but I don't want to scare her. So what do you need? Through the video feed, I watched as the woman's stomach twitched and quivered as it digested some bit of breakfast. Amy said, I'm not sure. You know, we're still just trying to help however we can. Well, I know there's more to this, said Loretta, causing a little flap of skin to bounce around her throat. Maggie wasn't acting right, before the abduction, I mean. I know this was something unusual. Amy said, has Maggie acted strangely since she's come back? Not considering what she's been through, you know. Can I see her? Loretta invited Amy to follow her to Maggie's bedroom, and the camera tracked the mutilated woman down the hall. She opened a bedroom door a crack and said, Mags, you awake? The answer that came from the bedroom was a terrifying guttural squeal. John glanced at me. Amy reacted like she heard an adorable child's voice and said, oh, you can just let her sleep. I didn't intend to. Loretta said into the bedroom, I have someone who wants to see you real quick. Won't be 1 minute. It's okay. She's helping the police. Loretta pushed the door open. Lying on the bed was a maggot. It was approximately the same size as a human child. Its skin was translucent, and I could see its digestive system working, grinding up what looked like scraps of meat and leather. John said, huh. I said, I'm going in. Wait. Amy said, Maggie? And moved gingerly into the room. The view from the phone leaned over the bed. Are you feeling okay? Maggie screeched and clucked and made sucking noises. Loretta sat down on the bed with Maggie, and the creature squished its way over to her. The mother laid her hand across the maggot's back, the monster's face resting a circular row of teeth against Loretta's abdomen. I'm just so happy to have her back home. My heart breaks for the other parents missing their babies today, but I have to admit, I'm selfish. I'm happy to have Maggie back, and above all else, I want to make sure they never try to take her again. If you guys can help me with that, nothing else matters. I knew that the lingering effects of the soy sauce were the difference between what John and I were seeing versus everyone else. If I concentrated, I found I could actually see the formation of fuckroaches swarming around the maggot, twitching and writhing in the vague shape of a girl. If I concentrated a bit more, I could see the little blonde girl they were projecting to the rest of the world, the child Amy was seeing, the one that had been woven into all of Loretta Knowles' memories. Then, in a blink, it was back to the larva, hungry, pulsing. Maggie opened her slimy mouth and took a bite out of Loretta's belly, ripping skin and fat and chewing noisily. Loretta didn't even flinch. Book 3. An excerpt from Fear, Hell's Parasite by Dr. Albert Marconi. There used to be a famous thought experiment that went something like this. A child is born blind. She has in her possession two wooden toys, a ball and a block. After years of playing with both, she knows the contours of each object intimately by touch, the sphere and the cube. Then, late in childhood, she is given surgery to correct her eyesight. Now that she can see for the first time, would this young lady be able to distinguish the block from the ball on sight alone? I say this used to be a thought experiment because we now know the answer. No. Real subjects who have had their sight restored upon seeing a cube for the first time cannot connect it with the 8 pointy corners they remember feeling in their hands. They fully expect it to feel like the smooth sphere until they hold it and learn otherwise. The lesson? You do not see with your eyes, you see with your brain. The visual data that enters your optic nerve is meaningless noise without the brain's ability to overlay meaning upon it. This means, quite simply, that what you see, in a real, not metaphorical sense, is a result of what you have been built to see, and nothing more. If you would like a comparison, imagine the family dog lying in a room while its masters watch a film on television. Dogs cannot see television, their eyes are quite different from yours, so all they know is that the humans in the room are sitting motionless, staring listlessly at a noisy square object on the wall. The canine may note voices or other familiar sounds from that device, but because those sounds are not accompanied by smells, they do not represent anything of interest to it. Even if the dog could learn to converse with humans, it would be next to impossible to explain to the animal that the motionless, silent people in the room are interacting with other living beings located thousands of miles away, performing actions that actually occurred years earlier. Which is to say, the family and the dog are in the same room, but experiencing very different realities. The very next day, the family takes that dog for a walk in the park. They are amused at how their pet frantically sniffs patches of grass, enthralled by seemingly nothing at all. They are mystified at its obsession with smelling the anuses of other dogs, yanking on its leash and discouraging it from indulging what they figure must be a curious fetish. How could the dog ever explain that its sense of smell is thousands of times more sensitive than theirs, that it can, in mere seconds, sniff out an entire life or death drama that played out in that very patch of empty grass weeks earlier? One whiff told the hound that an animal had recently urinated there, that said animal's metabolism was failing, and that it was extremely frightened. A sniff of another dog's posterior spells out its entire biography, its age, success as a hunter, its suitability as a mate, and or likelihood of winning a fight to the death. Same park, two different realities. This is despite the fact that man and canine both evolved in the same environment with extremely similar biology. Now imagine the difference between two beings who evolved in different worlds entirely. Knowing my line of work, I suppose you have already guessed why this is relevant to my interests. If a being from another universe were to appear in ours, our ability to understand it would be exactly as limited as the formerly blind teenager trying to identify his or her beloved toys by sight alone. Our brains would paw around madly for some context to make sense of the entity, but finding none, would frantically try to construct a crude analog. Some of us would see demons, some would see aliens, some would see nothing at all. When those conflicting impressions clash with one another, well, you need only to open a history book to see the result. We will live and die according to how we interpret the unfamiliar. All of human culture is nothing more than that very process playing out again and again. Chapter 18. Once again, Marconi selfishly tries to steal the spotlight. Amy slid back into the Jeep, took one look at our faces, and said, "What?" I said, "I don't know how to put this, but while Maggie appears to you as an adorable 8-year-old child, she is in reality a huge carnivorous larva that is slowly eating her mother." Amy said, "I guess I don't have to ask if that's just a metaphor. So during your drug trip, you left yourself a note to come here so you could see that, right? So now what?" "We have to kill it, Amy." "You're going to kill Maggie in front of her mother? You'd have to kill Loretta, too." "No, I guess we'd have to get her away from here." "Kidnap her, you mean? As in the thing you were accused of doing in the first place? Will you listen to yourself? Amy, it's a larva. That means it's going to grow into something, right? We can't let some monster hatch and go on a rampage through the city again." "Okay, let me ask you this. You see one thing, me and Loretta see another. How do we know your version is right? Is this some kind of Socratic thought experiment? We already know it's a monster. I mean, you see a girl, but it's actually a monster." "But I talked to her." "So?" "She was able to think and express feelings. Fear, affection, all that. Why doesn't she qualify for all the same protections we'd afford to a human who can do the same thing?" John said, "You didn't see what we saw. That thing is killing Loretta. Eating away at her, like taking literal bites from her flesh. I don't even know how she's still walking around." "She looked fine to me. Looked exhausted, but relieved." I said, "All right, this is exactly what you were afraid would happen. Do you need us to slap sense into you now? Just know that I intend to do the slapping on your butt, slowly." "If I'm not thinking clearly, show me where I'm wrong. I'll listen." "In Loretta's mind, it absolutely is her daughter. Did you see the look on her face? That love? It was real. You kill Maggie, that loss she'll feel, that'll be real too. Same as if you actually killed her kid." I said, "Maybe after the thing dies, the spell will be broken, like it was with Mikey. Let's put it to a vote." Amy said, "My vote is that I'm not going to let you do it, no matter how you vote." "That's not how democracy works." John's phone chimed an email notification. "Oh, hey, it's Marconi. He says he got the specimen and wants to talk about it, wants to know if we can do a Skype call." "What specimen?" John shrugged. "I guess we sent him something while we were tripping." "That doesn't sound like something we'd do. And by that I mean it sounds like a really good idea." Amy said, "That settles it. We go back to my laptop and talk to Dr. Marconi and we do that instead of murdering this child." I said, "For now. But if in the interim Maggie hatches and eats an orphanage, it's on you." Amy. They were several blocks from Loretta Knoll's modest rental house before Amy felt her guts start to loosen up just a little. This whole thing was giving her flashbacks. After the car accident that killed her parents and mangled her left hand, Amy had stayed with her Uncle Bill and Aunt Betty for 3 long, nightmarish years. The couple's marriage had always been a tire fire, and Amy could feel the tension crackling in the air every time she walked in the door. The two of them hated each other. They devoted all of their energy to inventing reasons to be outraged, each desperate to be the wronged party at any given moment, as if they were both keeping track on a scoreboard they kept under the bed. Adding Amy to the mix had been the proverbial bottle rocket to the hornet's nest. The aunt was the blood relative, Amy's mother's sister, and it had been her decision to take Amy in. Aunt Betty then kept insinuating that Uncle Bill had sexual urges for their 14-year-old houseguest. Betty had known it wasn't true. It was just the worst thing she could think to accuse him of. That's how it worked. Still, this meant that Amy couldn't just stay out of their vicious arguments because she was now a party to them. She was also the only one of the three who didn't seem to thoroughly enjoy the conflict. The tension made her physically ill. She wasn't used to it. Her parents had been best friends. Her father, an enormous man with smiling eyes, who had once spent 6 hours driving a young Amy from store to store, trying to find a copy of Final Fantasy II for the SNES, his little princess. But at Bill and Betty's, if there was ever to be peace for an evening, it would only be because Amy had devoted all of her energy to maintaining it, moment to moment. She would see signs of conflict on the horizon, say noticing Aunt Betty had bought Wonder Bread instead of Bunny, Bill's preferred brand, and 100% of the burden for smoothing it over would fall on her. The bread brand controversy had once resulted in Bill smashing a plate against a table and slicing his hand open on one of the shards. Amy remembered on one occasion throwing on her coat in the middle of winter and walking to a grocery store 5 blocks away, seeing they didn't have a loaf of bunny bread on the shelf, and bursting into tears right there in the aisle. The next morning, she had stood there in the kitchen with a ball of heavy acid in her guts as she watched Uncle Bill go to make toast. He uttered a sarcastic grunt when he noticed the brand. And that was it. He just proceeded to make breakfast like normal. On another day, that'd have been cause to punch the wall and scream the C word over and over, to sneer to himself and tell Amy about the time he had sneaked into the bathroom at night and put his own bodily fluids in his wife's face cream. The uncertainty was what made it terrifying. If the outbursts had been constant, she could have started to brace herself in advance, to turn it into some kind of routine. Instead, the periods of peace would last just long enough that the explosions would be jarring again when they came. To this day, she still gets this little thrill of fear up her spine when she passes a bread aisle, every single time. Amy was getting that sick feeling today, the sense that she was going to have to play referee in a fight that was just around the corner. But even that wasn't right. A referee at least has rules to fall back on. This was more like throwing yourself between two speeding trucks in hopes your squishy organs will be enough to blunt the impact. They don't make movies or video games about that person, do they? The nervous, muttering thing tasked with convincing the knight and the dragon that there's more than just one kind of courage. She reached up between the front seats and squeezed David's hand. Me. Academic, man of the cloth, author, adventurer, and reality show host Dr. Albert Marconi's most recent book mentions me several times, and each time makes me look like an asshole. So he's good with research. He does specials for the Discovery Channel about strange phenomena, and his production company has sent crews to Undisclosed at least half a dozen times. But Marconi himself has only shown up once in person. And in general, he only returns our calls when our situation sounds like something he could parlay into another book. Kind of like a doctor who will only take your appointment if your symptoms sound like some kind of horrific, undiscovered tropical disease that he can name after himself. We were back at Fort Beanie Weenie, and Amy was dicking around with Skype. If you're reading this in the future and Skype is no longer a thing, it was just a piece of video calling software people used back then. Or back now. Whatever. I said to John, "You stuck the fuck roach in the mail?" There was no concern that the thing would brainwash every postal employee who came within 100 feet of it between here and wherever the hell Marconi is? The memory is still fuzzy, but when I was on the sauce, I think I figured out a precaution. I don't remember what exactly it was, but I know it involved throwing a handful of sulfur inside the container, surrounding the interior with small mirrors, and then wrapping the whole thing in a dozen layers of aluminum foil. I also had thrown a couple of Oreos in with the creature, but I can't remember if that was part of the precautions or if I just wanted to give it something to eat during the trip. Marconi appeared on Amy's laptop screen.
A man in his 60s with a neat white beard, wearing a cream-colored suit. He was sitting at a desk, and, as I always did in situations like this, I wondered if he was pantless and only threw on the top part for the camera. It looked like he was in a cramped office, with various framed certificates on the wall behind him. I wondered how long he had spent framing up the shot to get those in there. Or maybe he was just the type of guy where you could point the camera in any direction nearby and find a cluster of accolades.
"Gentlemen," he said,
"and lady,
it is a pleasure to see you again."
Now there's a fucking lie.
"I'm speaking to you from the road. We are en route. I have the specimen safely behind foil once more, and inside of a locked safe for which only I have the combination. Keeping it contained has been an adventure, to put it mildly. One assistant became convinced that we had locked her house cat inside the safe, and became so hysterical she had to be restrained and sedated. As camouflage goes, it is impressive, to say the least."
I said, "You say you're on the way? I take it you're bringing a camera crew." I knew Agent Tasker would be very annoyed by that. Instead of answering, he said, "Tell me of how you encountered the specimen, from the beginning." We quickly told him all of the stuff that's in the story you've heard up to now, minus the parts about my depression and John's implausible cockboasts. Marconi listened to our tale and said, "Fascinating." John said, "Chastity, the second mother we dealt with, says there's a parasite that tricks ants into thinking they're fruit. They'll actually volunteer to be eaten. She thinks it's like that." Marconi nodded. "A more appropriate example in this case may be a certain species of fruit fly, whose female has evolved to look exactly like an army ant grub. It will land itself right among a pile of the ants' larvae, and the ants will unknowingly feed, clean, and protect it as one of their own. And while I do want to be cautious about drawing too close a parallel, these organisms are not of our world, after all. What we have encountered here very much appears to be a hive, in that we have multiple organisms working in conjunction, each of which appears to be very specialized."
I said, "Okay, so whatever's in the mind, that's like the queen?"
I was really just waiting for him to get around to the part where he tells us what magic is required to slay it, but Marconi likes to hear himself explain things.
"Let us, for the moment, speculate that the specimen you sent me is what in a hive we would call a worker. Let us further speculate that what is inside that coal mine is in fact a queen. So, the queen reaches the point in its life cycle when it lays its larva. But for some reason, its larva need human hosts to survive, presumably for food, but that is just a presumption at this stage. So, the worker's only job is to obtain those human hosts by any means necessary. It would appear to my eyes that these workers went into the world with the intention of duping humans into adopting larvae as their own. By imitating human children. By imitating human children who are in need of rescue. Note how far it went to present the supposed children's situation as dire." I said, "Okay, so Maggie went missing, and then Maggie did not go missing. There was no Maggie. The queen laid a larva in that pond near the mine, and the worker swarm went about convincing some humans to come retrieve it. Maggie never existed before that moment. The entire story, including memories of the kidnapping, was a brain imprint created after the fact." I rubbed my temples. "Right, okay. So Maggie was found at Mind's Eye, but Mikey just turned up in my apartment somehow."
"After you went to the mine?"
"Yeah. You must have brought it back with you, unknowingly."
"What, like stuck to my shoe or something?"
"These things are huge, but invisible if they choose to be. And that one was destroyed, you say?"
We all glanced at each other. John said,
Maybe. Last time we saw it, some guys at a motel were shooting it with shotguns."
"That should do it, right?"
Marconi said,
"They were shooting at the larva or the worker swarm that accompanied it?"
We didn't answer. Marconi read our faces. Let us assume, then, that that specimen is also still loose out in the world. But let's be clear. Hive-based organisms reproduce by volume. It is, in fact, the single reason they are successful. In this case, the queen presumably needs to continue to draw people to the mine. So now 10 more children have gone missing in the minds of the townspeople. Do we need to guess where the clues are going to lead the manhunt? I said, holy shit, that's a convoluted reproduction process right there. Have you seen what the human reproduction process is like, Mr. Wong? Here's a hint. The automobile you drive was almost certainly designed with reproduction in mind. Well, not my car, but point taken. Amy said, so we have to keep everyone away from the mine. I said, hell, they're probably already out there. Everybody knows where Maggie was found. It was in the papers. You'll have the bikers out there. Even the cops have to at least make a show of it. John said, oh, and before we go any further, we need to name the creature in the mine, the queen. It's Amy's turn. I think she referred to it as the creature with 1,000 butts earlier, so is that what we're going with? I said, she didn't, and that takes too long to say. Amy said, Millibutt. John said, done. Also, where does nymph fit into all this? Marconi shrugged. There likely was never such a man, or being, just a manifestation of the swarm. I said, but why? Amy said it before Marconi could. To give us something to save the kids from. We each saw the villain we needed to overcome. There was some sadness in Amy's statement that I didn't fully understand. So, John said, we go into the mine and fight the main boss. What can we expect to find in there? I said, and before you say it, yeah, we know to expect the unexpected or whatever. But let's make some educated guesses. Marconi nodded. Well, there are no uninitiated in this conversation, correct? Behind the veil of this world is a realm beyond the physical. The undying entities that dwell there do not have a shape or a size, but can only be measured in terms of their ability to exert will. I have reason to believe that the physical offspring we're encountering are one entity's way of inserting itself from that dimension into ours. I said, sure, so it's an evil spirit or whatever. I guess that means it's not flammable. Ask yourself how such entities would do battle with each other. The question is not merely academic within my school of thought. We believe we will find ourselves in just such a battle in the moment after death. Will versus will. Imagine a mortal body as an egg. When broken, what emerges might be a soaring bird or a runny yolk. And here I thought it was just a monster that wanted to eat us. In a sense, it is. Such a being would grow by subduing the will of others to its own ends. In our mythology, devils are always about possession and temptation, chewing up a human will until only a hollow puppet remains. You can decide for yourself at what point we can separate the symbolism from the reality. John nodded, knowingly. Exactly. It's just like those haunted puppets in your junk room, Dave. Marconi said, not in the least. To give you just a hint of the complexity of the task at hand, you will note that I have carefully avoided uttering the true name of the entity. It wants to be spoken of. I would suggest you do the same if and when you repeat this story to others. I was getting lost again. But how do we kill what we can't even? I was abruptly cut off by the sound of shattering glass. Chapter 19. The crew encounter some additional complications. John. A nearby window exploded, and a man came swinging in on a rope. John recognized the blonde beard on sight. He was pretty sure that they'd left the front door of Fort Beanie Weenie unlocked, but Ted owned line and a grappling hook, and by God, he was going to use them. He'd also brought reinforcements. A second window birthed a burly man in camouflage who had rappelled down from the opposite side.
Get the fuck down, all of you, suggested Ted. John, Dave, and Amy all got the fuck down, hands over their heads. On the laptop, John could faintly hear Marconi say, I suppose that concludes the call? That night in the parking lot of the flytrap, Ted had